Thursday, July 17th from 6 p.m. until 1 a.m. at Holocene, located at 1001 Southeast Morrison. This fundraiser opens with an ocean art show and silent auction, followed by a screening of the surf film Seven Signs. Then the reggaetronic five-piece band Everyday Prophets takes center stage at 10 p.m. Again, that's the Surf Rider Summer Soiree on July 17th. More information may be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Well, good morning. Show is Fight the Empire. My name is Per Fogring, and we have a special guest, an old friend of ours, Zahir Wahab, who is a professor emeritus from Lewis and Clark, and he went back to Afghanistan, his native country, but he's back in town for a few weeks anyway, and we're really very happy to have him here telling us what's going on in Afghanistan. Zahir, welcome to KBU again.
Good morning. Thank you. It's nice to be with you, Per.
Oh, it's just it's great to see you again.
Likewise.
We almost thought you were gone for good or something.
Well, I was gone for 11 months this time, which is a long time. It's almost a year.
That's right.
And I must say, it's strange being back. For one thing, you can't but make comparisons between, say, here and there, and also make the connections. And that is, it's almost like being on a different planet the economy, the freedoms people have here, the beauty, the natural beauty, but also the self-indulgence, the consumerism, the materialism, and the utter disregard for what happens to other people.
It's a bubble.
Yes, I feel like most Americans are so involved in their own lives that they forget or don't really care what the government does in their name and with their money, their trust, a government that keeps destroying other countries one country at a time.
Well, I think our educational system has something to do with that, and our media, that people are brought up to think in a certain way, and they, they're very surprised, like with all this influx of people from Central America coming into this country.
Yes.
All of a sudden it's like a huge surprise to people, but it shouldn't be.
That's right.
It shouldn't be. It should be. The logic is working itself out. The logic of empire is working itself out.
It's the blowback. I think you and I were both involved with the Central American issues when the United States was installing dictatorships and deposing progressive socialist-oriented governments in those countries. And now it's coming back to haunt this country. But, people talk about these children, but this happens in Afghanistan every day. This year alone, for example, 1,500 civilians have been killed, and a third of those were children.
Wow. And
these are UN figures, UNESCO, UN, and UNICEF. And also, people are trying to get themselves and their children out of the country by whatever means. And so you hear stories about Afghan children and youngsters being stranded or, drowning in oceans or being abused by human traffickers. But this happens all the time.
Where do they try to go?
Anywhere but Afghanistan.
Really?
I mean, people and adults too, especially right now with the uncertainties of the so-called impending troop withdrawal and the elections sort of uncertain. there's massive capital flight, but also people escaping, getting out anywhere, Pakistan, Iran, Europe, preferably the United States, Australia. And so there are it's a huge business, you know, human trafficking from Afghanistan is huge business. And you hear stories, you know, people dying or people being abused or people shipwrecked trying to get to Australia and other places. But no one is talking about that.
Well, we hear about people coming to Australia on boat. I thought they were usually from kind of Malaysia or Indonesia or something. But
those too. But, you know, we forget, and this is one thing that amazes me about Americans, even so-called progressives, how we move from one cause to another, and we can't seem to be able to stay with one issue or one cause. But, you know, Afghanistan is almost forgotten. You know, people have forgotten that this country still has the largest refugee population in the world. It has the largest percentage of asylum seekers, for example. It has the largest number of widows and orphans and people who have been mangled by the war and the conditions. But, you know, there's hardly any discussion of that here.
Well, let's talk about the election. That's sort of the big news now is these two candidates, Abdullah and
Ashraf Ghani.
Ashraf Ghani.
Both doctorate degrees.
Yeah, and I want what is the difference between them now?
It's Well, you know, they're both interesting. They're both clearly pro-Western and you know, Western-oriented, and they flaunt their credentials, you know, trying to outdo each other in terms of they will sign the treaty with the United States within the first 2 weeks. You know, they believe in the so-called free market economy. You know, they believe in American Western presence. You know, Ashraf Ghani, who is the better educated? You know, he has a PhD in anthropology from Columbia University.
Oh, really?
Yes, he's very smart. I have met both of them, but I know Ashraf Ghani more. He's very smart and then worked for the World Bank and taught at some universities here. So, and you can tell from his, you know, conversations, his work, he has done work on failed states, that, you know, the man can do a pretty good analysis, and he does have a plan. He does have a strategy for what to do with the country, and he does have ideas. But he's also very ambitious in that in order to become president, he nominated one of the worst butchers in Afghanistan's history. Rashid Dostum. Some people may remember there was a documentary done by a Belgium guy, Dashti Layli. Dr. Abdullah is a dentist, I think, or an optometrist by training.
So is Bashar Assad.
Yes.
Coincidence.
But Abdullah, you know, his most important credential is that he was the spokesperson for Ahmad Shah Massoud, the commander of the Northern Alliance forces. But in terms of their views and in terms of the class location, you know, they're very similar. And that is to say, they're both interested in power. I don't think either one of them is terribly committed to the plight of the majority, the vast majority of the Afghans. But the thing with the election is, you know, it's a farce in that holding election in a country where there has not been a census. No one knows how many Afghans are there, of which kind. You know, there has been no census since 1970. But also right now, if you went to Afghanistan, part of there are vast areas of the country that are outside of the government control. You know, the government controls some areas. The commanders and the criminals and the gangsters control another part of the country, the land mafia, the timber mafia, the drug mafia. And then the insurgents, the Taliban in various forms control in other forms. So to hold elections, you know, under these conditions and, you know, 70% illiteracy, you know, the oppression of women. At best, the elections really have been sort of a ritual for television and to please Western sponsors and patrons. But in reality, we all know, for example, that in all of these elections, there have been massive frauds and cheating.
Did people vote all over the country, or are there areas where nobody voted?
There were areas where there was no voting because it was impossible to hold even the nominal election.
But still, the amount of voters was more than they expected. I think 8 million or something.
Yes.
They didn't expect that many.
Yes.
Are they real people, or are they kind of
I would say
fictitious?
Maybe 1.5 to 2 million were probably bogus ballots. But in the primary, there was a in the previous elections, 2009, the turnout was pretty good. It was 65% of the eligible, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. All of these are estimates, of course, as I said, because there's really nothing credible. And that is, people are yearning for a government that would do what a government should do.
Mm-hmm.
You know. The country's on the brink in every way. The economy is, at a standstill. The World Bank tells us that in 2012, the growth rate was 13%. Last year was 3%, down to 3%. So whether it's the economy, whether it's the education system, the healthcare system, the highways, trade, industry, etc., things are pretty bad. And so people do. And more than half of the people are unemployed or underemployed.
Mm-hmm.
Per capita income, even after all these years of Western aid, per capita income is $517.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you look at any measure, the country is at the very bottom. It's truly a broken society. And so the new generation, the people yearn for a good government.
Did they ever have one?
Well, people talk about different scenarios. One, by some miracle, this election might produce the basic structure of a government that might then do what a government should do.
Mm-hmm.
The other scenario is that it will be just more of the same. No matter whether Mr. Abdullah wins or Ashraf Ghani wins, they will be muddling through. The third scenario is that things could get so bad and that the Taliban could take over. And the fourth is sort of massive chaos, a la Iraq. So you probably read in the news yesterday, for the third time this month, the insurgents attacked the Kabul airport,
almost
the same spot.
Mm-hmm.
2 weeks ago, they destroyed Karzai's two helicopters.
Mm-hmm.
And I can picture it because I just came from there a week ago. Yesterday was the third, and they fought off the security for the Afghan National Security Forces in ISAF for about 5 hours until they were finally eliminated.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you probably read about the fiasco in Helmand, for example. Remember Marja in Helmand, where the Americans and the Brits and the Afghans were supposed to have pacified the area. And now Helmand is back in the hands of the Taliban. You know, 2 months ago or so, about 300 Talibs, you know, fought off thousands and thousands of the Afghan National Security Forces.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where things are. You know, when you talk to people, their basic concern is lack of security, and there really is no security. The second thing is the economy, and third is unemployment or employment, and on. You know, lack of good education, lack of health care, you know, food insecurity. And it's just incredible that after 12 years of, you know, tens of thousands of American NATO forces and almost $100 billion spent on code development and another $700 billion spent on the military operation, most people are almost worse off than when they were 12 years ago.
Well, this is Fight the Empire. My guest is Zahir Wahab, who's goes back and forth between Afghanistan and here. And I guess, well, you know, actually, I think it was last year I interviewed an Afghan-American guy from San Francisco. His name's Ansari.
Yes, yes, Ansari. Yeah,
and,
he's a good writer.
One thing that he was saying was that on the village level, things are really kind of, he was sort of optimistic, you know, because, you know, it may be a very small village, but people are in contact. You know, they're not that isolated, and that if they're left, it may be that if they're left alone, they sort of develop, you know?
Yeah, in a way. I mean, in some ways, you can say, you know, when I was a child, there were no telephones in the whole region. But now, almost a third of the Afghans, if not half, have mobile phones, television, mobile phones, you know, the technology, radios, FM, AM stations.
Mm-hmm. Which depends on the power
supply.
Pretty
good press, yes. Mm-hmm. So there are these things, but this sort of, because of the terrible security situation or lack thereof, people are moving into urban centers. And so, but also the land is sort of being wasted. It's because of weather conditions and because you have to cultivate the land, you know, and you have to have the right kind of seeds and so forth. And these things are simply not quite available. And when farmers produce, but also because of land concentration. I mean, there's a land mafia in the country who have occupied vast areas of agricultural land, but also in the urban areas, even government land. And they're not interested in developing it and, you know, cultivating it. They want to build apartments.
Well, do people work on that land, or do they just, does it just sit there?
It just sits there.
Really?
You know, and so... And in the countryside, you know, again, there's sort of a, there are predatory elements, you know, commanders, independent commanders, warlords, strongmen, or these Afghan local police or Arbakis, you know, that the government and the Americans have installed for, quote, self-defense committees.
No boy.
Those are the most abusive, terrible. So life is rather made very difficult for the peasants or the people in the countryside. And their only solution is to escape to the cities, which means they would abandon a lot of things.
Well, then, then who grows the food if that happens?
Well, that's why the country imports food. It's a net importer of everything from shoes to helicopters to food.
Well, I understand that at one time Afghanistan was a very lush country.
Yes.
But you see pictures of it and it looks pretty stark and barren, you know?
I mean, well, because it has been deforested. I mean, the damage done over the last 35 years or so has been incredible. You know, it's a broken society right now, and that includes its institutions. And so to go back to the elections, for example, or building a government, basically... you know, the foreigners who sponsored this government and the constitution and the election system, et cetera, didn't really work on the development of institutions, like legal institutions, a bureaucracy, you know, statistics, education, you know, and things like that, or a government structure. And that's why there's almost like no government. Now, government is a problem. Because it's what you call a rentier government. Because government still, you know, 90% of the national budget is dependent on foreign assistance. It's 10% maybe generated. And that's because, you know, the government can't generate revenues because it's so corrupt, it's so inefficient, and so ineffective. So the people don't expect much from the government, and the government doesn't expect much from the people or fear the people. Neither is accountable to the other or responsible. It's like a parallel, you know. You have the people, and then you also have this predatory class which calls itself sort of as a government, when in fact it's just a bunch of criminal syndicates.
And
this shows a failure of the foreign intervention because, you know, people should have been building a decent government, and it hasn't been done. And so that's why I think the country is in real danger of what I call, you know, Iraqistanization.
Well, right now, you know, there's this big dispute over the election, and Abdullah is charging fraud, and Kerry came in. I guess he butted heads. They worked out some deal. There's going to be a total recount. Which is going to take quite a while, you know, I think
2 to 3 weeks
at least.
Yes, yes.
And in the meantime, things, I don't know, things will hold together. But an interesting thing is that apparently Kerry worked out a deal where whoever wins becomes a president, and the number two guy becomes kind of like a
prime minister.
Prime minister.
Yes.
And it's like... is sort of like they're switching the whole government from sort of a presidential government to, I guess, a parliamentary government or something like that?
Well, you know, the current system was made in Bonn, Germany. You remember December 2001? Mm-hmm. You know, the local Afghans really had very little to do with it. It was all the Afghan diaspora in Europe, in America, in Pakistan, and other places put together by the U.S., the U.N., and the European Union. And they put them on a plane, a British plane, and took them to Kabul. And then in a little while, people like Zalmay Khalilzad drafted this constitution. And Karzai, of course, even then, he knew this. And so he said, no, I want a strong presidential system, and I don't want political parties. So that's what's written into the constitution. But many people have been talking about this is like worse than a monarchy. The monarchy was more responsive to the people, but not the presidency that was made in America.
Well, they had a monarchy at one time, didn't they? Not too long ago.
Well, he was, yes. And actually, people are now nostalgic, not only for the monarchy, but also for the communists and even for parts of Taliban. Because, you know, things got done and the, you didn't have as much corruption or inefficiency or the sectarianism. So the election was very interesting, you know, because it came down to people voting ethnicity, really. In both the primary, the first election and the second round. And that's why the part that in the majority of the Afghans are Pashtuns, you know, 55% or so are Pashtuns, and they voted one way or another with the Pashtun candidate, which is Ashraf Ghani Ahmadzai. And the other side, I think when they realized, and they also apparently had evidence that there was fraud. And fraud is, there's fraud in every aspect of life in Afghanistan, you know, from higher education to the election system. So they went berserk. I mean, you know, people tore down Karzai's pictures in the National Assembly.
Oh.
And people took over police stations. The part that had lost, the Abdullah, took over police stations. And they talked about, you know, forming a parallel government and dismembering the country. Mm-hmm. And when I think the Americans, and you could see this, I mean, there are people, you know, there were demonstrations and sit-ins and on sidewalks. There still are. And people making a lot of noises and talking about, you know, parallel government and dismembering the country. Mm-hmm. I think Washington realized that this would be the biggest scandal in American history,
Boy,
I think.
After all these years and all, these years, all the money and lies and everything.
So I think Kerry dropped in and whatever pressure he used or promises. So now there's talk about, quote, forming a government of national unity. Mm-hmm. Whichever side wins would make provisions for the other side and will work on the Constitution, revise the Constitution, and switch from a presidential system to a parliamentary system in about 2 years. Now, you know, all of this sounds good if you could trust the system of, or if there were procedures or institutions or backup system, but one can never be sure, you know, how either side would respond when they realize that they have lost the elections and what it would take to keep the situation under control. This cannot really be predicted. The country continues to be on the brink.
Well, apparently both candidates. Was there ever a candidate who represented people that didn't want to have the Western powers in there?
Well, it was interesting. This last election, there were eight candidates for the presidency, including warlords like Sayaf, for example, and also the royalty, a nephew, I think, of the former king. But it was interesting because in Sherzai, who is a land warlord, it was interesting that the Mujahideen, two or three of the Mujahideen, got very few votes, 1.5% or so, which, you know, was very telling where the public, this new generation, is. And also the royalty guy got very few votes. So most of the votes were concentrated on these two people, Abdullah and Ashraf Ghani, because they're relatively new. And they were not involved in all of the, well, Abdullah was in a way, in the bloodshed, you know, in the sectarian warfare and all that. So The old guard and the Mujahideen and the warlords kind of lost, which was just as well. And mm-hmm. people, and you keep hearing this in the press. Remarkably, there's quite a vast free press, really. People talk, people mm-hmm. write, you know, and they say, we want to forget the past. We want to move on. We need new people and new faces.
Well, I wonder if they'll be allowed to.
That's right, because you know, there are these vested interests based on ethnicity, essentially, but also on ideology and in class. I mean, both Abdullah and Ashraf Ghani were government ministers. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, people don't expect a lot of change because we know these people. They were around. They have been around for the last 12 years. And their class interests, I don't know if their class interests would allow them to take on class domination or class exploitation. It is being said, you know, that about 100 families control most of the wealth there is.
Uh-huh.
Wealth in terms of contracts, you know, construction work, highways, providing fuel to the forces, you know, military hardware, etc. This is all controlled by about 100 families, and most of the wealth is taken out, especially mm-hmm. these days. People are worried about their money and their children.
Really? Well, we got a few minutes left. I was wondering, what is the status of the pipeline, the Tapi mm-hmm. pipeline? That was supposed to go from, it was supposed to bring oil from Turkmenistan through Afghanistan and wind up in Pakistan and India.
Yeah. And, it's still very much in the news. You know, now mm-hmm. there's talk also about Hillary Clinton's the new Silk Road, you know. But there's a lot of talk about how stability in Afghanistan is important to the whole region, Central Asia and South Asia, mm-hmm. because it's sort of like the bridge between North, Central, and South Asia, whether it's oil and gas, whether it's trade, whether it's transport, whether it's access to the seas. You know, the pipeline, the TAPI, Turkmenistan, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, is very much in the news. But I think the problem really is stability and insecurity, which is to say instability and insecurity, because for 150 miles or so, it has to go through Western Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And the Afghan government is in no position to guarantee security of the pipeline. And so people don't want to invest.
What about this Russia-China alliance that seems to be developing?
Well, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization.
Right, well, you know, I mean, like Russia's going to, they signed a deal for gas to China. And, the talk about pipelines and high-speed rail and everything.
Yes.
That seems to be the future of Asia. Yeah. Is Afghanistan going to be part of that, or will they still be kind of dominated by the West?
Well, I think, I think the West, that is to say the United States, is realizing that there's no military solution to this conflict,
mm-hmm.
and it just lost the war. I don't think, but also I'm sure that there will be a residual force, U.S. force, whether it's the CIA, NSA, or the military, there will be some of that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no question that the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, initially when this was formed about 10 years ago, Afghanistan was not even an observer member. And then slowly it was sort of being incorporated.
Oh, really?
Okay. As an observer. And now I think in the next meeting it will become an official member.
Mm-hmm.
The Shanghai Cooperation Organization, as you know, is in direct response to the U.S.-NATO encroachment on the Soviet, the Russia and China,
mm-hmm.
And so, but also Afghanistan itself has enormous resources, and when China and Russia are very acutely aware of that.
Okay.
They want these for themselves, and they want the West as far away as possible. So I think the struggle over Afghanistan and its resources will continue into the future.
Well,
I'm afraid.
I hear my music playing. This has been really very, I wish we could go on longer.
Yeah.
We've been talking with Zahir Wahab, who is a retired professor emeritus from Lewis and Clark. And
makes you sound ancient.
Sort of our man in Afghanistan. Thank you very much for being with us.
You're quite welcome, Per. Thank you. Thank you again. It's nice being with you.
And stay tuned. Always something good on KBOO, your radio station.
Yes, you are listening to KBOO Portland with 1 minute before 10 o'clock here on this Thursday. Coming up in 15 minutes on Flashpoints, a report today from an international solidarity activist currently in the Gaza Strip. Ali Abu Nima of the Electronic Intifada discusses a peace proposal being floated by Hamas. And the director of the National Day Labor Organizing Network talks about the politics of immigration in the U.S. At 11 on Between the Covers, host Jay Thiemeyer speaks with Portland writer Smith Henderson about his highly praised novel, 4th of July Creek. Set in Montana, the story explores the complexities of freedom, community, grace, suspicion, and anarchy. But first, at 10, it's Air Cascadia. Headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. That's coming up next on KBOO. Thank you for listening to KBOO Radio, and thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
And they'll be mine, all mine, practicing 24 hours a day, 365 days a year.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Northwest Film Center screening of The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T as part of the Cinema Under the Stars program on Thursday, August 7th at 7 p.m. The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T is a musical fantasy film with the story, screenplay, and lyrics written by Dr. Seuss. Before the film, the Grand Style Orchestra will be playing a set of improvisational free jazz music. Again, that's The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T, part of the Top Down Cinema series of the Northwest Film Center, on August 7th on the roof of the Hotel Deluxe's parking structure at Southwest 15th and Yamhill. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Cascadia. Today is Thursday, July 17th, 2014.